conference record has joined the conference.
All right, so this is Ken Ross from Michigan Credit Union League. I'm going to hold off for a couple minutes to allow people to get back on the line. Chuck Holtzman, are you on the line?
I am, Ken, thank you.
Robin Hoag, are you on the line? John Moreno, are you on the line?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Robin Hoag, are you on the line? Robin Hoag, are you on the line?
Ken, Dave Adams here. I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to be on the call.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
We're going to start a little
bit
later.
Do we have Robin Hoag yet? Wait a few more seconds and then start up.
Hey, am I muted?
I can hear you.
Oh, I guess I'm not.
All right, we'll start the second call. For those of you who weren't on the call just now with John Koloff, we walked through for the last hour. The guidance that was issued yesterday by the Department of Insurance and Financial Services on deferred benefit plans and CSD plans. After the overview, John answered questions, which wrapped up just 2 minutes ago. So the purpose of this follow-up call is to provide a industry-only call hosted by the Michigan Credit Union League for Michigan Credit Unions with the goal of providing additional background on key legal accounting insurance perspectives as well as some next steps and to offer another opportunity outside of the regulator's ears on additional questions and answers and next steps. Additionally, I'll mention that everyone should have received today along with the email reminder of today's call, all credit unions would have gotten a CSD checklist, which represents an informal communication of key areas of examiner focus. So this is not the certified DIFS or credit union division checklist that they'll be using. But it is a document that that is not marked by them, but is being used by them as a key set of checklists and concerns that they're looking at when they're looking at any of these plans. Additionally, the Michigan Credit Union League will be developing best practice guidance for credit unions who do not have CSD plans to provide boards with and senior management with insight on key things to consider if they're considering any of these types of plans, which will be issued in the relatively near future. So today, hello?
Hi, Ken, this is Tony. You said you sent out a checklist or a checklist was sent out?
Yeah, one was distributed today. Did you get that?
Was it from you or who was that from?
Oh, it's from Dave.
No, Tony, it would have been included on the reminder.
Okay. Must have just missed
anyone
it.
Anyone who doesn't have it can feel free to email me, and I'll be glad to send you a copy.
Yep.
ken.ross@mcul.org.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So as we heard from the call today, I'm just going to do some initial comments and then turn it over to discussion from legal, accounting, insurance perspectives. As you heard from the discussion today, John and the Office of Credit Unions did encounter these plans and have been concerned about them for some time. They most particularly focused on them this year as they were preparing a bulletin, and they, you know, sent examiners out to kind of see what was in the field. We've been working with them for several months here at the league level, along with Chuck and Robin and several affected credit unions as different permutations and drafts were worked through. There have been, I can tell you, intense engagement with John over the last several months, meetings. We've supplied him with language to refine and focus his bulletin and have challenged the way that he was framing some of the issues in some of the earlier drafts. And the current focus, which is largely on due diligence, ongoing monitoring, providing consistent accounting and gap reporting, and a big goal of his has been from the beginning to bring the transaction onto the credit union's book, provide some kind of recognition of the transaction. I think we were largely successful in taking out some of the more, I think, unintentionally, from their view, hostile language to CASD plans. Instead, like Chuck said, try to allow for their existence with flexibility and potentially amendments as necessary. So we're going to jump right into some brief perspectives on the guidance and what we just heard, and to recap, followed by question and answers. Most importantly, I'll ask again each of the commenters to focus on next steps that they see coming out of that discussion. So first, from a legal perspective, we'll go to Chuck Holtzman.
Thank you, Ken. As I had mentioned during the last call, I was actually glad to finally see the bulletin come down. For those of you who I may have worked with, especially on collateral assignment split dollar plans over the last couple of years, there has been a big debate with the regulator on the applicability of 4012SS and 423 of the Michigan Credit Union Act. And I think realistically, either argument, whether it be our argument or the regulator's argument, were equally reasonable interpretations of the act. And I have said to DIFs on more than one occasion when they would interpret these as loans rather than viewing them in the big picture as investment vehicles, where's your authority for that? And they didn't have any until yesterday. Yep. And now the authority is there. So whether we like the authority or not, the reality is we have clear guidance. And now that we do have clear guidance, we can move forward with these types of plans and eliminate some of the regulatory controversy and some of the regulatory scrutiny that some of the credit unions have been under for the last year or two. As I said in the earlier call, there really is nothing in that bulletin that can't be addressed by some fairly simple amendments to some existing plans. Whether or not a particular credit union will want to amend their plans, that's going to be a decision between the credit union, the executive, their CPA, and their attorneys. But as we heard during our call with John Koloff, there are facts and circumstances under which credit unions can book CASD plans at the higher value, and there are circumstances under which we can record income off of those plans before the income is actually received by the credit union. It's really going to be a function of the contractual documents and the due diligence documentation. So as John emphasized on several occasions, we really need to focus on the written documents. We need to focus on documenting the board's due diligence as they go through. In terms of next steps, I really think that every credit union that has a deferred compensation plan at this point in time should probably be pulling that plan out, wiping the dust off of that plan and taking a look at it. We'll want to take a look at it in a couple of contexts. First, you'll want to review it in the context of this bulletin to make certain that the actual plan document meets the minimum requirements that this bulletin suggests the plan document should have. And in my mind, it doesn't matter whether you have a collateral assignment split dollar plan, a traditional split dollar plan, defined contribution plan, or any other type of 457F plan. I think it's important. It doesn't even have to be a 457F plan, but just about every type of deferred compensation plan should be looked at, and it should be reviewed to make certain that we comply. It should also be looked at, and each credit union, if you haven't had your CPAs look at it, I think you do need to have your CPAs look at it in order to ensure that the accounting is consistent with the type of plan that you have and the requirements of GAAP as they apply to that particular type of plan. Every deferred compensation plan prior to yesterday required a legal opinion, but the legal opinion only was required to address whether or not the plan complied with IRS regulations dealing with deferred compensation. The bulletin that was issued yesterday takes that a step further and requires that the legal opinion not only address compliance with IRS rules and regulations, but also outline the rights and responsibilities of the credit union as it relates in the plan. And I think that probably every credit union that has a deferred compensation plan out there is likely going to need to obtain that type of an opinion, which will also help document the board's understanding of the credit union's obligations under that plan. And I think where the regulator is coming from, to a large degree, it's in the collateral assignment split dollar plans, because those plans can have a tendency to last 10, 20, 30, 40 years into the future. And I think the regulator just wants to be certain that there's documentation at the board level to make sure that the board understands what that obligation is and that they have some understanding as to how that obligation may affect things that the credit union wants to do in the future, such as impact on earnings, impact on liquidity, impact on recruiting a new executive when your existing executive who has that deferred compensation plan decides to retire. So those are all going to be something new and something that everybody who has an existing plan is going to have to look at. And then lastly, I think it's important, especially for those credit unions that may have had plan documents drafted by lawyers other than who may have drafted either an employment contract for the executive, and if the executive doesn't have an employment contract, then we need to go back and look at personnel policies and personnel handbooks. Most deferred compensation plans, in order to comply with IRS rules, have to have an element of forfeiture. If there is no element of forfeiture, if there's no risk of forfeiture in the plan, the IRS rules say it's all taxable today. It can't be deferred. And the way you do defer is to have some element of forfeiture within the plan. What we need to look at, most plans address forfeiture in the context of termination for cause. And we need to make certain that the definitions of for cause as they exist within the plan documents are going to be consistent with what may be in an executive's employment agreement. And if there is no employment agreement, then whatever policies or handbook may be applicable to the employment situation with that executive. Because one of the things that most executives aren't going to do quietly, and that is walk away from a deferred compensation plan. We have seen instances in the past where executives have misappropriated money from the credit union, engaged in egregious violations of policy or egregious violations of law, only to challenge the board's determination that their termination was with cause and therefore a forfeiture of the deferred compensation plan. So from the credit union's perspective, they have to assume that if there is a falling out that would trigger a forfeiture of the plan, that likely is going to create a legal dispute between the executive and the credit union, and therefore the credit union needs to be certain that all of the legal documents are consistent so that we don't create a field day for the lawyer somewhere down the road, spend 2 to 3 years litigating the issue of the termination and forfeiture only to end up in a situation where the credit union pays out a significant benefit in the context of a settlement. So that's why I say now is probably as good a time as any to pull those documents out, dust them off, have them reviewed, and make whatever changes may be needed in order to ensure that the benefits that the credit union promised the executive are properly set forth within the document and everybody clearly understands their legal obligations going forward.
Okay, so Chuck, I hear you saying top three things are review your documentation for your existing plan in light of the new bulletin, make sure that you have a legal and CPA review that outlines the rights and responsibilities of the credit union, the executive, and then thirdly, making sure you're harmonizing that agreement, if it's a CASD agreement, with your executive employment contracts to make sure you don't have any out-of-sync language there.
Absolutely. I think that's a great summary, Ken. Thank you.
All right. Is Robin Hoag on the line?
Yes, he is. This is Robin.
Robin.
Hey, Ken, I'm here.
Thank you. I'll turn it over to you now for feedback on what you heard, insights, as well
sure.
as, importantly, next steps.
Oh, thanks, Ken. Yeah, I think that there's been a lot of great discussion, and it's starting to provide some great clarity. The bulletin is nice because at least we know what the expectations of the regulators are, and it's in writing, and we know how they're going to view each individual item, even though there might be some differentiation from plan A to plan B or credit union to credit union exec to exec. If you boil it down, the actions that the credit union is going to need to take are this. You need to take a look at the cash surrender value of your plans and make sure that you've educated the board on the difference between the cash surrender value, future funding requirements if you've got four or five or six or ten more payments to be made on these plans, and if it's a collateral assigned split dollar, you need to make sure that you've gone back and you do an appropriate underwriting on this loan. If the credit union's plans under when you have them reviewed, if they don't have recourse, you're going to need to decide between the board and the executive whether you're going to put a provision for recourse. Putting the provision for recourse is only one step. That in and of itself won't accomplish the ability to record this at face value for the loan. You're going to have to go in and acquire and document a capacity to repay, an intent to repay, and capacity is going to be based on either cash flow from some other source or by assets that are either liquid assets or other assets of an executive that could be liquidated if there was an early termination and the board pursued repayment of the difference between the cash surrender value and the loan on the books. Also, if you expect to record any income from a cash, a collateral assigned split dollar program, you're going to have to follow the exact same underwriting and prove that it can be paid. Chuck, I also wonder if between the insurance entities, the executives, and the boards, that we're going to have to set up some type of cash payment plan sooner than 30 years out to document that the accrued interest is actually going to get paid at sometime in the future. Otherwise, the annual review is going to have to be able to look at the cash surrender value of the policies, the accumulated unpaid accrued interest, and then the outstanding principal, and there'll have to be adequate capacity and intent to repay to be able to record any income under this bulletin. So we've got value, the value implications, the interest implications, the collateral requirement for both getting adequate collateral if there is no capacity to repay adequately documented. And John had indicated one item that I thought was interesting, that there's going to have to be some appropriate collateralization language, documentation, or linkage between any assets that an executive has. And Chuck, when I'm done with my comments, you may want to comment on that again, because I sense that it's very important. You need to update all your documentation, education of the board, the checklist, the leaks sent out. Make sure you go through that in very, very, very great detail and include your board of directors in the summary and the completion of that document and update it on an annual basis. Because as many of you know, the way that the regulators identify whether the board's been adequately involved is between board minutes and documentations. And if they are at a board meeting, questions and that they might pose to your various directors. Also, one of the things is should be documented of the compliance with Section 423 for your loan limits, and then going back and making sure that the current outstanding balances and any future payments don't exceed the 15% limitation for well-capitalized credit. One other point, any credit union that might have one that is not in the well-capitalized area will probably have to have a higher level of due diligence and make sure you talk to your attorney and your accounting firm to get clarity and get this well-documented, because otherwise you'll have extensive exam findings. So with that, Chuck, can you comment possibly on that the collateralization concept that John talked about, which if an executive provides a personal financial statement and shows they have the ability and the assets to repay the difference, it sounded like the regulators wanted some type of direct language, document, or security interest that allowed them to pursue that.
Thanks, Robin. I do want to address that because there were a couple of questions that were asked of John that made me cringe a little bit only because of my history in dealing with the regulator on deferred compensation plans. And I think on two or three or more occasions, John was specifically asked to try to define what capacity to repay means or to address specific scenarios in order to determine if that would meet the, quote, capacity to repay, close quote, standard. And I was glad to see that John didn't jump at the opportunity to do that in answer to any of the questions. I think he kept his comments and the bulletin to be quite flexible in order to determine what capacity to repay means. Does that mean that the executive has to have the sufficient cash flow in order to make amortizing payments over some reasonable period of time? Does that mean that the executive has to have net value in their personal assets that are going to be equal to or greater than the shortfall between the aggregate loans and the cash surrender value? Does that mean that the executive is going to have to pledge those assets as collateral to the credit union for that shortfall? And the answer is there is no requirement. The answer is that it's probably going to be some combination of those. I like the fact that the bulletin says that the credit union should consider obtaining additional collateral, but the bulletin doesn't require that you obtain additional collateral. And if I were an executive, I'm not sure I would be willing to pledge my personal assets at that point in time in order to make up that shortfall. So I really think, Robin, and we're going to really need to take a look at this on a case-by-case basis and be able to be comfortable from both a legal and an accounting perspective that we've got sufficient facts and circumstances to be able to argue to the regulator that there is sufficient capacity to repay demonstrated here within these documents. Now, I will tell you, I looked at an exam report just last week where the examiner, in talking about a specific CASD plan, mentioned the fact that the board did not obtain additional collateral to cover the shortfall. And my recommendation to the credit union in responding to that portion of the exam report was to acknowledge that that's correct, that they didn't obtain because there's not a requirement to do so. So I think that one of the things that I would probably ask the credit union to take a look at would be, let's take a look at a financial statement of the executive. Let's see what the net worth is. Let's potentially take a look at the executive's cash flow situation so that as a lawyer I could make an opinion that in the event the executive were required to honor that recourse obligation, could I issue an opinion that there's a sufficient likelihood of collection? And I think that if we can demonstrate a sufficient likelihood of collection, I think we can demonstrate that capacity to repay element.
Robin,
Robin,
one of the issues that I heard from a number of credit unions is there was a variety of ways in which these plans were being reported or not reported. Did you think coming out of the call that people got sufficient clarity on how to report and what to report?
I think what to report, there was clarity. I think there was clarity from John's point of view. I'm not sure if everyone in the audience was comfortable. Basically, the collateral side split dollar programs, basically, I would draw the conclusion that if you don't have the documentation of the positive intent and ability to repay by the executive with recourse in the note, then you're not going to be able to book it at face value. You've got to, under the regulation, you're going to have to write that down through an allowance for loan loss adjustment down to cash surrender value. And because he's going to assume that without that, it's collateral dependent. And that's a fair assessment from a commercial lending point of view.
Robin, this is John Moreno from Keita Mutual Group, and that was something that I heard a little bit of a discrepancy between what you're saying now and what I heard on the call, and I would like your clarification if you don't mind. And this was, I think, a part that the gentleman from Channel Lodge brought up, but what you mentioned was the fact that you would write down or book into your calculation of allowance for loan loss reserves the difference between collateral value and the loans that have been extended to the executive. And so, you know, as far as that collateral value short of those loans, you would take that difference and essentially add it to your calculation for loan loss reserves. What we heard on the call was that the way that the regulator looks at the loans is the primacy of repayment source, which is, in essence, from the regulator's view, the individual, not necessarily the collateral or the product. And in these plans, I mean, by design, the repayment is the death benefit of the policy, not necessarily the executive making a stream of payments back to the policy over their life. So, you know, in terms of that piece, do you see an effective argument, and Chuck, I'll direct this to you as well, do you see an effective argument being made to say, look, we're only booking the difference because, quite frankly, the pledge to repay this loan is partially based on collateral, death benefit if it extends to the length of term it's supposed to, and or other assets of the executive?
Yeah, I would say that based on all of our conversation with John and the way the bulletin is worded, that the relying on the death benefit is not an acceptable methodology at any level to record anything but the cash surrender value of the document or of the plan. Period. There was no point in any of our calls or discussions or in the language that is in this document that would allow you to rely on the death benefit of these insurance policies as repayment. Because if the credit union becomes 4% capitalized and under prompt corrective action, the regulators have to take action and either take over control as conservators or liquidate a credit union. They can't go kill the CEO to recover on the policy. So,
what we call the New Jersey recapitalization plan.
Right. That's frowned upon.
No. That brings me to the second part of the question, which is should we recognize the difference, only the difference between the collateral value and the loans extended? Because what I heard from the call with John was that the total amount of the loan should be added to the loan loss reserve calculation versus just that shortfall of collateral.
No, I think you misinterpreted what he said. He was saying only the shortfall between the collateral surrender value and the executive's ability and intent to repay and proven capacity to repay. If you take those 2 points, and let me give you an example. Let's say the loan outstands $1 million, and let's say the cash surrender is $500,000. So you got a shortfall of $500,000. The CEO proves he has a positive intent or she intent to repay, and they can cover another $300,000, and it's well documented and substantiated that additional $300,000 capacity. The allowance for loan loss under the bulletin would be $200,000.
Perfect. That's what I wanted to hear. So that's exactly, I mean, not what I wanted to hear, but that's consistent with logic. I appreciate
yeah.
that.
If I could just jump in for just a second, this is Chuck Holzman, and add a comment. You know, the issue of whether or not these should be even treated as loans has really been the issue that we've been debating with the regulator probably since May. Michigan is in the substantial minority right now that treats these types of deferred compensation plans as loans to executives. My understanding is NCUA doesn't treat them that way. Most other states don't. Our position was that these really aren't loans. These are really funding vehicles and funding schemes that utilizes a loan scenario in order to achieve certain tax benefits and certain accounting benefits.
Unfortunately, we were never able to make a whole lot of headway with that argument, and John's position pretty much from the get-go was, if you're going to design these things to look like loans, then you're going to have to abide by loan rules in terms of the maximum individual obligation that you could extend to one member and the like. His position seemed to be credit unions have multiple options on how to structure funding for deferred compensation plans. This was only one option, and therefore, if credit unions wanted to use this option, one of the benefits that they get is some favorable accounting treatment if it's set up appropriately, but on the downside, it is a loan, and therefore, executives have to recognize that there is a bit of credit risk in connection with the recourse obligations. I haven't seen a collateral assignment split dollar plan yet that didn't have a recourse obligation in them. Some of the recourse obligations are stronger than others, and whether or not when push comes to shove, the credit union's going to enforce it, who knows? But the fact of the matter is these things are designed from the regulator's perspective to get favorable treatment because of the lending characteristics to them, and therefore they've just decided that we're going to have certain lending principles apply to these plans across the board.
Thanks, Chuck. And John Moreno, would you give us any insights or feedback based on what you heard from CUNA Mutual's perspective?
Absolutely. From the final point that John made on the call is what I would consider the imperative for the entire call or for the entire engagement is the board has got to be aware of what they're entering into, what the consequences are, and what the long-term costs are. And I can't stress enough that from a vendor perspective, it is oftentimes challenging to gain an audience with the board simply to review the existing plans that they have. One thing I could see coming from this bulletin, in addition to clarity and a lot of the other options or alternatives, is the fact that there is now an imperative for the board to pay more attention to these plans, be more versed in how they work, what risks they pose, the longevity that they have, and the potential future costs they might enter into for the credit union. And I can't see that being anything more than constructive for the membership of the credit union. From a secondary standpoint, I can't tell you how many times we've had plans, and we of course work with many states where it's one auditing firm's opinion versus another, depending on whose auditor is in place in terms of how these plans are accounted for and how they fall onto the books. Having any additional guidance is constructive to having these plans be accepted more broadly as an option for a credit union to consider, and also having guidance in terms of how the costs of these plans need to be weighed relative to other potential alternatives. Because that, again, is part of the biggest issue that we face is how do you judge a plan that may provide the same after-tax benefit but ends in 10 years versus an alternative which seems to require less funding but extends for potential, as Chuck indicated, 10, 20, 30, 40-year time frame for repayment. How do we make those two equal one another so that the board, in English and in terms that they understand, can make a differentiation between the two and do what's best with the members' money? So from my opinion, I don't think the opinion is anything but constructive. I think it gives us clear guidance in the state of Michigan. There are a few questions, of course, need to be answered and clarified, but that's the same with any type of emerging bulletin or regulation.
All right, so now we'll open it up for questions from any credit union participants on the call. What questions do you have?
Ken, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. This is
yes,
Mike Monroe. A little bit early, but I'm just kind of thinking out loud. When it comes to the spread between the cash value and the face amount, Robin used a good example. Let's say it's $1 million and the shortfall is $500,000, and the exec does have the ability to cover that $500,000. Whether or not they accept that or not, would it be wise to book the interest if you are going to go down that road, or do you think it'd be permissible to even do a mixed bag, for the lack of a better term, where even if the executive has the ability to repay the cash shortfall, not to recognize the interest income until such a time the true cash value equals out the face amount? Or should it be consistent? Or Robin, is that too early to make that determination?
In a certain way.
Right, right.
That makes sense.
So, Robin or Chuck, do you want to weigh in on some of the considerations that you would evaluate when you were looking at a situation like that where the cash surrender value was below the book value and determining whether or not you should book interest or not?
Sure. I'll jump in on that. I think that, Mike, the safe answer, if you want to play on the safe side, is don't book the interest until the cash surrender value exceeds the outstanding obligation. Then the regulator never is going to criticize whether or not you've appropriately documented the capacity to repay issue. But some credit unions have been recording that interest, so I can appreciate the fact that, A, they don't want to stop recording it, and, B, they don't want to reverse the interest accrual that they've already taken place. So in those particular cases, I think it's just going to be a function of trying to get as much documentation as we can to make the individual examiner who's going to review this comfortable that the executive has the capacity to repay. But I think that that's going to be an issue that's going to be different not only from credit union to credit union, but from examiner to examiner. I think one of the things that DIFS has tried to do with this bulletin is to generate some consistency among the examination staff. And I think to a certain degree they've achieved that. But I think in some of these details, we're still going to see some examiners who are going to say, well, I don't consider that the capacity to repay is here unless we have additional collateral. Other examiners are going to probably view it in a different. So I think this is probably going to be an issue that we're going to be debating on a credit union by credit union basis going forward.
And, Michael, I have two comments on it. I had somebody step on my I couldn't answer before Chuck did because somebody stepped on my call. I apologize. Here's the thing. I agree with Chuck what Chuck said. There's a conservative approach. The ultra-conservative approach is don't create revenue that you don't think you're going to be able to complete the revenue cycle, which is the receipt of the cash, within a reasonable, appropriate, definable period of time. If the cash is going to come in when the executive retires, then you got a definable benefit where you could design the cash payments to start paying the interest at the executive's retirement, along with the executive's annual benefit. That would be one way to take a conservative approach that would allow you to define and complete the revenue cycle. The other approach is don't record it and be ultra-conservative so you don't have a bone of contention with the senior staff. The third option is to go ahead and record it, indicating the fact that the revenue will be achieved, although it'll be achieved at some future undefined point in time. But then, as Chuck mentioned, and I totally agree, you're going to have to every year, and as that accrued interest gets larger and larger, you've got a $1 million plan, and it runs up at 1% or 2% or whatever the federal defined rate is for a midterm, short-term, or a blended rate plan. When that starts to hit $1 million or $2 million of outstandings, even in a small interest rate, those are going to start to become big dollars. So I think you need to be very careful and sensitive about your choice to be either ultra-conservative or to be willing to make sure that you can support every year there's a capacity and attempt to repay both the outstanding principal and the interest by the executive, especially if they're going to look very closely at early terminations. Is does the credit union have the capacity? If there's a $500,000 shortfall, will the executive cover that if in year three of a 10-year agreement that executive terminates or is terminated with or without cause? And they've got a couple of situations that are out there that they're experiencing, and they're using those as examples from their point of view.
Other questions? Who's got another question?
I have a question. If we have had this plan on our books for a while and have already booked interest income from it as you know, we've
All right, we lost. I heard you have a plan on books, on your books, and your booking interest, and I lost you after that.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Can you hear me?
Yes, better.
If we've had the plan on our books for several years, and we've been booking interest all along as we thought was okay to do, do we have to go back and reverse that interest?
Is it a BOLI plan or is it a collateral signed split dollar plan?
Collateral signed split dollar.
If it's a collateral signed split dollar plan, I believe the regulators, unless you can prove the intent and ability to pay by the executive that has recourse and appropriate documents, I believe they're going to start pushing back and they'll want those either reversed or they'll want an allowance set up for it, one or the other.
I also think part of the issue is going to be whether or not you've had a CPA audit done during that period of time and whether or not your CPAs have opined in writing that the accounting for that was appropriate during that period of time. I think that in the event a credit union were to have something in writing from a CPA indicating that they were in compliance with GAAP in the booking of the interest, then I think that a strong argument can be made to the regulator that the interest accrual was appropriate and that there shouldn't need to be any type of reversal or a reserve setup.
And then you have the question, Chuck, about do you keep accruing interest or do you just continue going forward?
Yeah, I think that's agreed, Robin, and that would be an issue we just take a look at on the individual case-by-case basis and try to determine the strength of the opinion that the credit union has from their CPA. I mean, if their CPA actually looked at the intent and capacity and there was documentation to support it, then I feel comfortable going to bat for the credit union to argue if the regulator felt otherwise. Again, it's really, as John said, so much of what's going to happen on a go-forward basis is in the quality of the documentation.
Absolutely.
Chuck and Robin, actually, to support or to align with that question, one of the issues that's going to come up is the intent capacity repay and documentation of the intent capacity repay. And as we know, with most normal loans, the credit union is essentially one part of the transaction, but they're essentially underwriting for the interest of their depositors and members and their capital levels. In this situation, tasking an individual within the chain of command of the CEO would represent a conflict of interest in terms of verification of income. The CEO self-reporting, basically kind of self-documenting their financial capacity to repay would be, again, potentially a conflict of interest or definitely a conflict of interest. Is there a need to have a third-party or an auditing firm as part of their general audit request independent verification of assets that would be potentially used to satisfy those collateral requirements? Or is there some other method you would suggest? Or is self-declaration acceptable in this case?
We have seen so far in one case that self-declaration was adequate. It was not challenged. As long as it was timely information and that wasn't created just as a result of the exam, that it pre-existed and it was evaluated. And then I think going forward, if they're timely updated on an annual basis, I don't believe they're going to require, unless there's a belief, suspicion, or identification that the information on the self-applied or self-created financials is not believable or is not accurate. I don't think they're going to go that far at this point in time. But if you were underwriting that to a regular member, you know, how contemporaneous would you get in the documentation of a personal financial statement if you gave them $1 million loan for a cash surrender value of $500,000? In other words, how would you make sure that you had another $500,000 to ensure that you didn't have $500,000 unsecured? I would go to the exact same extent you would on your commercial loan portfolio.
Excellent guidance. Another question was, because Michigan is unique in treating the loan limitations separate apart from the investment limitations of the Act, do you see that there's a potential or a reason that a credit union would be allowed or within regulatory framework acceptably able to go beyond essentially each of the individual limits to essentially have collateral support dollar that over time would lead up to 25% of current capital levels, and or a BOLI type of investment that stays within that 15% limitation or 15% materiality provision of the separate part of the act? Or do you think that there's some aggregate standard that the credit union should hold itself to?
Well, I think the aggregate standard it should hold itself to, one, the regulators, and Chuck can dive in on this, the regulators have no authority to violate law. They can only interpret regulation, and they can allow waivers of certain regulations, but if it's in law, they can't waive law. The other part of the question is, do I think that they'll look at it as an aggregate individually? I think it's a function of the capital and the profitability of each credit union, and they're going to look at the concentration risk based on capital and profitability and executive management of each credit union, from what I've seen.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. The 25% limit for the collateral assignment split dollar plans, the legislature established that, so the regulator, by defining these to fall within the loan powers of the credit union, there's no way of getting around that. The 15% is really just a guidance in determining materiality.
Yep.
It's not a hard, fast rule. I think I could make strong arguments for credit unions to exceed that under specific situations. I think there's also arguments that could be made where something under 15% could be deemed material just based upon the risk profile and balance sheet of a particular credit union.
A credit union with 7%, 15% might be too high. A credit union with 9, 10, 11, they might be willing to waive the 15% or allow an exception.
So essentially you would see both being treated independently but factoring into the review of each other. So essentially the review of the 25% being a ceiling set by the legislature, if it's deemed unsafe and sound due to BOLI holdings or some other type of investment holdings, could theoretically be restricted, and conversely, BOLI holdings could be restricted based on the safety and soundness view relative to CASD holdings elsewhere on the credit union balance sheet.
Yeah, so keep in mind, the 25% is only going to apply to a CASD plan. It's not going to apply to a BOLI plan or just about any other type of deferred compensation.
Just one other comment, a little different track. Just to let everybody know, NCUA, John had mentioned that NCUA was working on a task force. They've been working on this for well over a year, and Ken, you and your team might even know better than I do, but I've talked to their chief accountant four or five times on this topic, and it was a hot button, and now it was backburnered. I suggest that with Michigan going on record as to what their expectations are regulatorily, that it might give NCUA a push to get theirs done. So I think we'll get new guidance at the national level also.
Who's got another question? Any more questions for accounting, legal, insurance?
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
This is Donna Hubbins-Schiffer from Frankenmuth Credit Union. I had a question when they talked about what we need to report on the call report. Those unfunded loan premiums, if we have not been including those in the call report and we're now going to start doing that, do you think we need to go back and amend any prior call reports?
They have not indicated in any of our conversations that they expected credit unions to go back and amend the call reports. They just expected them to do them correctly going forward. So if you, since it's not the 19th or the 20th of October yet, I would just make sure that your September call report includes this, because the guidance was issued before your call report was filed.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Chuck, would you agree, or do you think?
Yeah, I would concur in that. I think that if they ask you to go back, you would only really need to go back first and second quarter of this year. But I think if credit unions start following the call reporting guidance beginning as of September 30, that should be sufficient. One of the things that John has acknowledged is that the call reporting really is not set up appropriately for this, and that is something that NCUA will be working on.
So you might want to be paying attention for changes in the call reporting instructions on a go-forward basis also.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Another question?
Well, if there's no more questions, I want to just say thank you to Ken and Robin, Chuck, you know, for taking this by the horn, spearheading the whole thing for you, for guidance and clarity. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. All right, last call for questions. All right. So anybody coming out of this call who has a question that they would like to pose to the credit union division for which they don't feel comfortable posing directly can feel free to call me, or you can email me at kenross, ken.ross@mcol.org. As was stated throughout the both calls, good advice for everyone interested to brush off their plans, as well as checking in with legal and accounting for review of the plan and compliance with the new guidance. Anyone who has specific questions that they want to have clarified specifically by John can feel free to contact us if they don't feel free to contact him directly. And we will have, as I said earlier, more guidance coming out for those who don't have CSD plans in terms of providing best practices in the relatively near future. Anybody who didn't get a copy of the exam checklist can feel free to give me a call or shoot me an email, and I'll be glad to redistribute it back out to you. Once again, thank you very much for participating for today, and have a good rest of the afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.